Full Story is supported by Australian Industry Group, Australia's largest and most experienced industry association. From workplace laws to skills shortages and compliance, Australian businesses face challenges every day. Supporting over 60,000 businesses nationwide, Australian Industry Group is Australia's trusted business partner for compliance, advocacy and growth. Members enjoy the benefits of instant HR and legal advice, along with access to a team of experts in workplace relations, compliance, legal, skills development, apprenticeships, and more. Whether you're shaping strategy, managing people, or driving operations, Australian Industry Group exists to help businesses of all sizes thrive. Learn more and join today at australianindustrygroup.com.au.
This is The Guardian. Regid Ahmed here on Gadigal land with the full story. As the Jewish community continues to grieve after the Bondi Beach terror attack, the focus also turns to how it can be stopped from happening again.
We feel absolutely shattered. We feel that we've been abandoned.
And it feels almost like we were unheard, almost invisible.
That includes a focus on anti-Semitism.
I've been holding my breath, fearing that something like this would happen, because it hasn't come without warning.
And a change to our gun laws.
The very nature of our gun laws means that they are only as strong as the weakest link, which is why we want to make sure that they followed Premier Minns's lead.
After revelations that the alleged gunman, a father and son duo, used legally obtained weapons to commit the massacre, questions are being asked about how best to strengthen gun control laws that were once considered world-leading. Today, Investigations reporter Ariel Bogle and political editor Tom McElroy on a moment of reckoning for gun reform and the pressure on the PM to do more to make the Jewish community feel safe. It's Wednesday, the 17th of December. Hi, Ariel. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good to be here.
Australia thought that we had the gold standard of gun control laws, limiting the number of guns that could be out in the community. But you found that there's greater gun ownership than perhaps we realised.
Yeah, so as part of an investigation into firearm ownership, gun control here in Australia earlier this year, the Guardian Investigations team looked at those numbers, and we really found that gun numbers were on the rise, and the Australian Institute has looked at this too. You know, there are now more than 4 million firearms in the Australian community. That's almost double the 2.2 million weapons recorded in 2001 after the National Firearm Agreement. You know, and when you bring up this number, a lot of people point to the growth in population levels, but there is now a larger number of guns in the community per capita. So that's really because a lot of people, a lot of individuals own a lot of guns, even in the wake of the Bondi terrorist attack. One of the alleged Bondi shooters owned 6. I think people might be shocked to find out that in suburbs of Sydney, there are individuals with legal ownership of hundreds, even up to 300 firearms.
It's been described as a frightening concentration. Why do people own all of these guns?
Well, one of the key reforms after Port Arthur was that people now needed a genuine reason to hold a weapon, to own one. And this could be, of course, if you needed it for agricultural purposes, you're on a property. If you were a hunter, you could get certain types of hunting licenses. And we've heard that one of the alleged Bondi shooters had a recreational hunting license. But there are certain different avenues to get these permissions. And that's another of the issues that we looked at. One sort of thing that has been described as a golden ticket in getting a recreational hunting license is something called a permission to shoot letter. And that's been a big problem in New South Wales historically, where certain properties issue permission to shoot letters and they never really get scrutinised again, whether that reason still stands, whether the property is still operational, all these questions. And in some cases, some properties were giving out really quite a significant number of permission to shoot letters. And that has been cracked down on more recently with a new system called GunSafe. But that's just one example of the way these little corners of the gun control system can kind of get out of control.
So is that because people have been getting around those landmark Port Arthur Massacre gun control laws? Is that why the number of guns has been able to grow?
I think what we're talking about here is perhaps our gun control regime is a little past its use-by date. You know, things have changed. The boundaries have been able to be pushed. We are here talking about legal gun ownership. Illegal gun ownership is a whole different ballgame, although there can be a kind of porous border between the two where legal firearms enter the illegal market through theft or other means, which we also looked at as part of our investigation. But really what we found was an issue of scrutiny. You know, licenses once issued were not re-examined. The reasons why people were accumulating large number of firearms or even ammunition were kind of being missed because registries were out of date, sometimes still operating on paper. There were a lot of reasons why we weren't able to have a good bird's eye real-time view that would allow a police to have actionable intelligence about sort of anomalies in the gun control system that ought to be looked at more closely.
So after the Bondi Beach terror attack, the government's now mooting a whole bunch of changes. Could that plug these holes that you're talking about?
Well, it really remains to be seen. What's on the table there about limiting the number of weapons one individual could own or changing the rules around requiring people to be a citizen before issuing a license, that's for gun control experts and I think law enforcement to tell us whether that would help them. I think one thing we've been looking at closely as part of our investigation was the National Gun Register, which was sort of mooted even after Port Arthur, but has sort of remained pretty moribund since then. It was only in 2023 after the Weambilla shooting that it got back on the national agenda and states and territories kind of committed to pushing that forward. It's meant to be operational by 2028. And there's been some murmurings today from the Prime Minister and others that they want that to be brought forward. But I think they have a big task ahead of them because when we were looking into it, we found there are a lot of reasons why that registry has been quite difficult to put together, not least that a number of states still operate largely on paper when it comes to their registry. I think in the Northern Territory, they were asking firearm owners to take photos of their weapons to register them. So there's a lot of challenges in building a real-time, actionable intelligence national firearm registry that would give police officers and law enforcement kind of clues about where the issues might be.
Ariel, thank you so much. All right.
Okay.
Hi, Tom. It's good to see you as Canberra keeps reacting to this attack in Bondi Beach.
Thanks, Reggie. It's good to be with you.
We've spoken to Ariel about the growing prevalence of guns in New South Wales, but now the Prime Minister and New South Wales Premier seem very keen to do something about it.
Yeah, I think changes to national gun laws, the state and territory gun laws and settings at the national level, are one of the first tangible takeaways from this awful tragedy. National Cabinet met on Monday afternoon, 24 hours on from the shooting, and discussed possible changes to laws that would restrict the number of guns people can own and things like licensing provisions and how long a license could last. It seems like the state and territory leaders, as well as the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, want to move fairly quickly in tightening up some of these rules. Essentially, so there is a better check on people who have weapons in the community for protecting against a repeat of this kind of event.
In order to make changes to gun laws, do all the states and the federal government have to align? Like, how would they work together?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Most of these laws exist at the state and territory level, and I think that's the opportunity of National Cabinet. And as we've often seen after crises, putting everyone in the room straight away, trying to get as much momentum out of the devastation has been successful. Law reform after the Port Arthur massacre is considered the gold standard here, and I think they're trying to replicate that a little bit. After the National Cabinet meeting, they agreed to a set of steps, which Chris Minns from New South Wales and Roger Cook from WA are going to lead over the next few months. They include things like speeding up the National Firearms Register. We've known that project has been in the works for a few years, and it's been sped up a couple of times, but this seems to be another opportunity for the federal government to move faster in bringing together all the data that the states and territories have. Then there are a couple of other things fitting into that, allowing criminal intelligence information to underpin who can get a license. That seems like a straightforward thing, but it's proven difficult over the years. Limiting the number of guns any one individual can own. We're not sure what that number is going to be. That could potentially be a political challenge and require a bit of salesmanship around the country. They're going to limit open-ended firearm licenses, so people will have to reapply and therefore resubmit to a security check or whatever they need for the gun license to be put in place. And interestingly, a condition for holding a gun license in Australia will be Australian citizenship. Obviously, one of the shooters in this case was an Australian citizen, the other came here on a visa. I think that's something that both sides of politics will probably agree with, that Australian citizens should be the only ones able to have Australian gun licences.
You mentioned the Port Arthur massacre and the gun reforms that followed. There's been a lot of comparison and discussion around that. Is the criticism that those big reforms that were celebrated have been watered down since they were implemented, or is it that we never fully implemented what those reforms were?
I think it's a bit of both. Something like the National Register of Firearms is an example of a proposal that was put in the public discussion after Port Arthur back in the late 1990s, but never actually realised. In fact, the proposal for a national register goes back further than Port Arthur, including to the Hoddle Street shootings in Melbourne and other massacres involving guns. It is an example of something that hasn't been fully realised. The other proposals, I think, are about strengthening the Howard-era gun law reforms and acknowledging that there are actually more weapons per capita in Australia now than there were in the Howard era, and that changes in technology and threats from people bringing guns from overseas, or indeed things like 3D printing of guns, need tightening. So I think this is about strengthening those landmark reforms, trying to bring them a bit more into the modern era, considering that it's a complex picture around the country and settings are different in different places.
And is there any discussion about finally implementing a national firearms register?
Yeah, the federal government has committed to that, and it looks like it'll be in place in a couple of years' time. The original timeframe was about a five-year process. It evidently is a very complex thing to put in place. As the Prime Minister has pointed out a few times, some states and territories were using paper-based systems and coordinating the data, having the proper infrastructure in place for this system to exist and for it to be useful to law enforcement agencies and people approving gun permits is going to take some time. I think the reality is we're talking about 2027, something like that at this stage for a national register.
So when we look at the politics around getting these mooted reforms through, is there bipartisan support? Where could we see the pushback?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, and I think it's quite dynamic already. The coalition say in principle they're on board for law reform around guns, but they want to see the specifics from National Cabinet and from the state and territory leaders. I think that's the opposition trying to keep the focus on the Prime Minister on the question of anti-Semitism and whether the government was slow or weak in responding to the threat facing Jewish Australians. They don't want the conversation to move too far into the gun law reform space, which they see as less politically advantageous. However, as we've said, most of the changes look like they're going to be at the state and territory level, so it will be up to premiers to push them through. I think perhaps at the state and territory level it could be slightly easier. Of course, the gun lobby is powerful in Australia, and some political parties, most notably the Nationals and the Shooters and Fishers, will have strong views on gun law reform. But I think we'll see relatively speedy movement in this area, and I think that will be a sign that the Premiers and the federal government are trying to maximise the progress that can come out of the awful tragedy at Bondi.
You mentioned former Prime Minister John Howard. He has just spoken about the gun laws and his view of the attack.
Well, the general observation I want to make about focus on guns, it's welcome always. But I do not want this debate, the focus on guns, to be used as a pretext to avoid the broader debate about the spread of hatred of Jewish people and anti-Semitism. And I see in the behaviour of some people.
What did you make of the comments?
John Howard's record here is known the world over. You know, he wins great praise for standing up to the gun lobby, indeed standing up to elements in his own coalition at the early stages of the Howard government after Port Arthur. He said that the federal government has been too weak on dealing with anti-Semitic behaviour and sentiment against the Jewish community, and that the gun law reform question is slightly secondary. He also says that the likelihood that tougher laws would have prevented this are probably difficult questions, given this was a father and son and they hadn't risen to the level of the security agency's attention. However, I think longer term, probably this is going to go through. I'd be surprised if the coalition maintains an opposition to it or indeed opposes it in future. So I think the federal government is going to try and use the mantle inherited from the Howard era to push these through, and I think the state and territory leaders will use that as well.
John Howard made an interesting reference to Ahmed Al-Ahmed, who took on one of the alleged gunmen.
He self-identified as a Muslim. That is a reminder that this is not about sectarian division. This is about pure hatred.
Do you get a feeling that was a bit of a rebuke to perhaps those in the coalition who might be connecting this to the immigration debate?
Of course, we know that the coalition wanted to have a big debate about it. Indeed, they were preparing to release policy principles for a new immigration framework as soon as this week. I think that's been delayed. We've seen Andrew Hastie, the Liberal backbencher from Western Australia, already, Tony Abbott, the former Prime Minister as well, pointing out that one of the gunmen had come to Australia on a student visa and wasn't born here. I think it's risky territory to go down that road. I think clearly these gunmen were motivated by hatred of Jewish Australians, hatred of the Jewish community. And so it's risky to lump all immigrants in with them or to suggest that immigration is a security risk to Australia. It would be difficult politics as well, I think. Making that case could risk politicising what has been a horrible loss of life. But as I say, people like Tony Abbott and Andrew Hastie are already talking about the settings around immigration and whether they're adding to the security risk from extremists in the community.
Do you think there's any kind of danger here for the Prime Minister if the coalition seeks to suggest that dealing with gun laws means they're ignoring anti-Semitism?
I think the PM is already vulnerable on the question of dealing with anti-Semitism. The government hadn't responded to the Gillian Siegel report from 6 months ago about the kind of discrimination and abuse and safety threats that Jews in Australia were facing. And people like Josh Frydenberg, the former treasurer, indeed Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, have already said that the warnings that they made, that the Jewish community made to the government, were not listened to, and that led to this extremely distressing and dangerous situation in Sydney. He pushes back very strongly on this criticism. He says that the government's done everything possible to improve safety around Jewish community sites and places of worship and made inroads on some of the other recommendations from the Siegel report, including on education and social cohesion. I think you can see some frustration from the Prime Minister when he's facing this criticism. I think he believes that it's partly politically motivated, and I think if it continues to dog Labor in general, it's going to be challenging to shake off for the PM, especially when there is such vociferous criticism coming from overseas and people who have lost loved ones in the shooting and Jewish community leaders who are really, really rocked by this are so passionate in their criticism of the government.
Just finally, where can we perhaps hypothesise that this will go next? Do you think the Prime Minister will be keeping John Howard in mind and the way that he sort of forged some sort of legacy on gun laws, and he'll be trying to do the same thing?
I think he could do well to do that. I mean, it was an example of political risk for the Prime Minister of the day. He had to bring people together and hold them together and make the case publicly. You know, there's famous footage from that time of John Howard being heckled at public meetings where he was trying to explain the need for tougher gun laws. And the benefit for his legacy there and for the law as a whole was very positive. You know, for a long time, those laws have kept us safe. They've taken dangerous weapons out of the community. So I think following that playbook could be good for Anthony Albanese. Of course, the situation is slightly different. The weapons involved are different. The reality facing governments around the country is different. Whether he's able to shake off this persistent criticism that he hasn't been tough enough on anti-Semitism and that he hasn't kept the Jewish community safe, I think is probably the bigger question for him and for the government going forward.
Tom, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks, Rajid.
That was political editor Tom McElroy. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert and Joe Koning, who also did the sound design and mixing. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. Don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Regid Ahmed. See you soon.